On Wednesday, July 26, from 1 to 6 p.m., WBAI salutes one of the most memorable events in the history of the Americas, A Portrait of Cuba, produced by Samori Marksman and Rosemary Mealy. Moncada, 36 years of combat, construction, and victory. That's this Wednesday, July 26, 1 to 6 p.m., A Portrait of Cuba, over listener-supported, non-commercial WBAI radio.
And you are listening to WBAI in New York. It's 7:32 time now for a special presentation, Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. Couldn't get my throat, but if they could, they would. So then you bounce over the test, test the words. I hope that's understood, so then you know.
Good evening. This is Emmanuel Goldstein, and the program is Off the Hook, dedicated to the telecommunications revolution, computer hackers, phone freaks, and all those amazing things that you probably don't understand. We're going to try to make it a bit more understandable, and we're going to be talking about a case which has been in the newspapers, which has been butchered and horribly misrepresented, and perhaps at the end of this hour, we'll have a better sense of just the importance of computer hackers and what's really going on out there. By now, you've probably heard the name of Kevin Mitnick, which is the name of a hacker in California. Last December, Kevin Mitnick was arrested for computer hacking. That's something that seems to be spreading, seems to be going around a bit more. Computer hackers actually getting arrested for playing with computers and for saying there are different people over the telephone, that kind of thing. Well, Kevin Mitnick was supposedly, and all of this is according to what is said in the press, Kevin Mitnick was supposedly the best. This guy could make you believe anything when he was talking to you over the telephone. According to newspapers, he was described as 25, an overweight, bespectacled computer junkie, known as a dark side hacker for his willingness to use the computer as a weapon. His high school computer hobby was said to have turned into a lasting obsession. Now, he allegedly used computers to break into Defense Department computer systems, play around with business computers, and harass people. Supposedly, he disconnected Christy McNichol's telephone number. What was unusual about this case, or most unusual about this case, was the fact that when Kevin Mitnick was arrested in December of 1988, he was held without bail. People around him were drug dealers, kidnappers, all kinds of mean, nasty, ugly things. They were walking in and out, getting bail, but Kevin Mitnick, a computer hacker, is still in prison. He has not been out of jail one day since he was put in jail in December of 1988. And I suppose one of the questions we'll be asking tonight is why that is. Now, Mitnick's family and attorney have said that prosecutors have no evidence for the accusations. They are blowing the case out of proportion, either out of fear or misunderstanding of technology. And that's another issue that we are going to be addressing. In 1981, Mitnick and three other group members were arrested on charges of stealing technical manuals from the Pacific Telephone Company. He was caught again by University of Southern California officials in 1983, trying to break into the school's computers. In December 1987, he was convicted of stealing software from Microport Systems in Santa Cruz and was sentenced to 36 months of probation. In another incident, Mitnick supposedly fled to Israel to avoid prosecution after being accused of tampering with a computer storing credit information at TRW. Again, all of this is based on what has been reported in the media. Now, what made Mitnick the best, according to those same sources, was his ability to talk people into giving him privileged information. For instance, he'd call an official with a company that he wanted to penetrate and say he was in the maintenance department and he needed a computer password. And he was so convincing that they would give him the necessary names or numbers. Now, last Tuesday, a week ago today, Kevin Mitnick was sentenced to a year in prison. Counts the amount of time that he has actually been in prison already, so he will be out of jail in December of 1989, and after that, he has to serve 6 months in an addiction clinic. Yes, Kevin Mitnick has supposedly been addicted to computers all of this time. Well, we have on the line with us Kevin Mitnick's lawyer, Alan Rubin, in California. Mr. Rubin, are you there?
I'm here.
Was what we said so far, was any of it blatantly wrong?
Well, with regard to many of the things that were reported in the press originally, they were blatantly wrong, and many things the government originally said were blatantly wrong, and they've come to admit it. Starting at the beginning, what I remember from the introduction, with regard to break-ins into the Defense Department, government originally accused him of breaking into National Security Agency and other Defense Department agencies, which in fact they have now verified, as we say stated all along, that there never have been any such break-ins, and Kevin never committed any of such break-ins. Indeed, the way they originally made the mistake demonstrated their own lack of knowledge about computers. They looked at the name of some computer disk that was found that had been named by another individual who was in the case, named Lenny DeSico, who had given it a shorthand name, not knowing that somebody can name a disk anything. They can give, they could call it Hitler's Diaries or the name they want to give it. Mr. DeSico had given, called it NSA List, and they immediately assumed it was the National Security Agency list of some classified material. In fact, it was not. It was totally unclassified material off a public university.
So, based on one law enforcement official's misunderstanding of a computer disk, this entire thing was played throughout the international media.
That's part of it. I mean, I give that example as just sort of an example of some of the paranoia that I felt was going on and the immediate overreaction by the government to the situation, that they were immediately willing to jump to a conclusion and had him detained without bail. And what was significant about without bail was, while there were others, as far as drug dealers and so forth, who were kept without bail, they still have access to telephones. The key thing with Mr. Mitnick is he was even kept without access to a telephone, fearing that he could do some damage from the prison with a telephone. Because of that order, he was ultimately kept in, the only place they could enforce that order was to keep him in solitary confinement, where he was locked up for 23 hours a day. And that was far more brutal than most drug dealers get, most armed bank robbers, just about everybody in federal prison gets, unless they're a discipline problem in prison, which he certainly wasn't. Again, there was another misunderstanding of how the technology works. The prison telephone calls are all collect telephone calls. You cannot call a modem or access a computer from prison. All calls must be collect. Again, the government doesn't understand the technology or was unwilling to accept it and just wouldn't listen.
Do you have any idea what it was that they were afraid of? What was it that Kevin Mitnick could do if he was able to access some kind of a computer on the telephone?
They never answered that. At this point, I guess what happened was, in the climate of the virus problem with Robert Morris and Syracuse, and I want to emphasize that Mr. Mitnick, Kevin, never planted any virus, never did any damage to any computer, and this has all been admitted to by the government at the sentencing, that they finally, after a lot of screaming by myself and the defense, when they finally checked out the facts, there were no viruses, there was no damage, there was nothing except an illegal access, a trespass, if you will, into the computer. And what's significance if anybody, any lawyer knows what would happen if somebody trespassed into a store and took a computer program from a computer software store. And they'd probably get a few days in jail or a fine, and that would be it. The fact that he did it by computer as opposed to physically walking in to the store and taking a program seemed to make all the difference in the world to them, and he wound up with a lengthy sentence, though I might add, significantly lower what they were originally talking about.
And what was that?
There were times when, frankly, the prosecutor, the original prosecutor on the case at the very beginning of the case, were talking in terms of 3 to 5 years in prison. And I should also point, some of the other things you mentioned in the introduction, he never fled to Israel. Mr. Mitnick has never been to Israel. His passport demonstrates that. I mean, all they had to do was check his passport.
Okay, so how would something like that be reported in the press?
Well, the government stood up at a bail hearing and either intentionally or unintentionally told the judge that they have information that he fled to Israel, when in fact the only time he's ever been out of the United States was on a one-day vacation to Tijuana, Mexico. And his passport confirms that. But again, it was such an overreaction, and the government frightened the judge. And the judge, not knowing really who this is, relies on the government. And if they tell her that this man is a security risk, is going to steal defense secrets, she believes him. And in order to be safe, she kept him without bail. And frankly, the whole case ultimately was an effort by us to try and sort of unroll the snowball that started in the press and started in by the government. This Kevin is not in any way a, quote, dark side hacker, is not a vindictive person. And indeed, for example, the story with Christy McNichol herself has verified to us that not only were her telephones down, did Kevin never shut off her telephones, but her telephones were never shut off. The event simply never happened.
Christy McNichol herself says this.
Absolutely. And this is just simply one of those apocryphal tales that gets spread around. And of course, as Kevin got a reputation, it was easy for other hackers, if they wanted to blame him. Or there's a very common concept known by defense attorneys among the police, known as clearing the books. Whenever they have a set of cases that they can't figure out who did, they find, it's sort of like Casablanca, round up the usual suspects, and they find a computer hacker, or in cases of arson, an arsonist, and they blame all of them on that one person, and that clears their books of unsolved cases. And that's what happens, I presume, in many of these cases. The truth of the matter is that many of the incidents simply never happened. He was accused of making, changing credit records of the judges that he was in front of. We investigated that, contacted the judges. They said it never happened. I mean, all kinds of stories like that. But the government, rather than, in my judgment, sadly, when you lock somebody up, this is not Iran or Russia or another totalitarian country, supposedly. And when you lock somebody up without bail when they're presumed to be innocent, you better do it for a real good reason. And rather than really checking it out and make sure they had their facts straight, they overreacted and blew the situation out of proportion and locked them up. And from that point on, in the legal system, it's very hard to unroll the snowball as it goes downhill.
Now, Alan Rubin, as Kevin Mitnick's lawyer, you've been exposed to the world of computer hackers. Is this the first time that you've been able to see this world?
It is, and some of it is simply because this is the very first computer hacker crime that's been prosecuted in the federal courts in Los Angeles, and indeed is probably one of the first ones in the United States. The federal statute that just went into effect in late 1988, and so the first cases are really coming forward now. It's a frightening thing in my mind, because people are so, or at least government officials, are so frightened of people who know computers and who access computers that, again, I just think they completely overreact. The example I gave, you know, there should be no difference of about somebody taking a program if they walk into a store versus taking it by computer. There's no difference.
Do you see wider implications for this kind of misunderstanding and fear of technology? How would it affect the average person that really doesn't have an interest in computers?
Well, I don't know if it's going to affect the average person. The average person may be giving some impetus to the government in the sense they know that they have private records on computer disks and the government is reacting to try and protect them. I think, unfortunately, there may be a lot of kids or young hackers who don't really see themselves as doing any harm that may get caught up by the law enforcement system, be given criminal records. One of the saddest things, obviously, Kevin is a talented guy in computers, and our country needs those kinds of people who have that kind of talent. He would desperately like to be in the computer industry, providing productive use of his talents. Because of the criminal situation, it may be very hard for him to get employed and for his talents to be used. And I'm afraid some of the best and the brightest, if you will, may wind up in that situation.
And Kevin has been sentenced to stay in jail until December and then be treated in an addiction program. Is that correct?
That's correct. And frankly, that was a very good result considering where we were. At one point, the judge had refused a one-year sentence and had stated in her judgment it was much too lenient. It was only after we had been able to demonstrate to her that there were certain elements of his behavior that were similar to an addict's behavior, the long hours at the machine, the high, if you will, of computer hacking were very similar to what you see in cases of drug addiction and alcohol. And once the judge and the government saw that, then the picture started to change of him from this dark side hacker to someone who does have a certain type of compulsive behavior about computers. But in no instance, and I want to emphasize this, did he ever do anything vindictive or evil. Even in this case, as I said, he never damaged anything, never planted any virus, never stole anything for profit. The only program that was taken was simply so that he could study it and learn about the operating system. He has an intellectual, challenge and as an intellectual challenge and desire to learn about the operating systems there. That's the reason he accessed the computer, for no other reason to simply learn about the system. No profit motive. Really, almost pure hacking, if you will, just for the pleasure of it or for the intellectual challenge of it and to see if it could be done rather than for anything that you would consider real base or evil motive.
We're speaking with Alan Rubin, who is Kevin Mitnick's lawyer, Kevin Mitnick being a computer hacker in California who was arrested last December and has been held without bail. He was sentenced last Tuesday to serve a year in prison and have that followed by 6 months in an addiction treatment center. The case has been rather strange, rather bizarre, because of the hardline attitude of the courts towards this person who was playing with computers. It's the first time that we've actually seen a case of a computer hacker going to jail and being treated in a very harsh manner, as we've heard, actually being put in solitary confinement so that he would not have access to a telephone. I'd like at this moment to introduce John Markoff, a reporter from the New York Times. Mr. Markoff has been covering the Kevin Mitnick story from the day it began in December of last year. And I'd like to ask you, John, is this an unusual kind of story? You've been following computer hackers for a while now. What's different about this case?
Well, I think what's different here is a matter of degree. In a sense, Kevin's case was one that was waiting to happen, as there have been a variety of these legal incidents over time, and the proximity of Kevin's case with the virus, the internet virus, was, I think, he picked the absolutely worst time to get himself arrested, in a sense. The country and the government in particular was really looking for an example, and Kevin, for a lot of reasons, turned out to be the perfect example. Also, I think that, I'd maybe ask Mr. Rubin to explain a little bit more about the particular software that Kevin was caught for, because it's, you know, I have a little bit of difficulty with the issue of whether it's just the same as walking into a software store and taking a program off the shelf.
Do you think it's better or worse?
Well, there are programs and there are programs. I mean, this is the program that Kevin took was essentially the source code to a security module for the Digital Equipment Corporation's operating system. He couldn't have picked a worse program to go after to make the company uptight, and they were extremely uptight.
Well, how was he able to get a hold of that? Was it left out in the open?
Well, in a sense. I mean, it was left behind locked doors, if you will, but it was sitting on a shelf. And I think Mr. Rubin is right. From a hacker's point of view, this is the perfect object of intellectual curiosity. You have to look at it from the company's point of view. From the company's point of view, here they find some unknown individual coming in and essentially taking the crown jewels. This is the particular program that protected the operating systems, ultimately their hardware and all of their customers' hardware all over the world. So it was enough to send them into an absolute panic.
Were they harmed? Did something happen to the company as a result of this?
That's a good question. They were harmed in the sense that they directed their security personnel to spend a ton of time trying to track down Kevin. I don't think the company lost anything materially because of who he was, but they didn't know who he was. And as a matter of fact, I've heard that they actually thought that this was a penetration run by the East Germans at first. Now, if you have that point of view from within the corporation, what's your attitude going to be? What they did makes a lot of sense at that point.
Mm-hmm. Let me just say one thing. My understanding of what was taken, and I'm my understanding of that what was transported was simply a program that emulates, somewhat ironically, hackers to see if their security systems are secure. To a certain extent, it's less valuable. It has no commercial value. It's not something you can buy in a store, kind of program they sell, and it has certainly no commercial value. I would also point out it is true also as far as loss to the company. The only loss to the company was the computer downtime, which they value at whatever they want to value it. It's like saying how much is your time worth, and they pick out a number, and that so they can inflate the amount of damages by simply picking out a higher number. One thing I think cannot be underestimated in this, with Deck screaming and really seeking prosecution, is that to a certain extent it's extremely embarrassing for them. I mean, they are a computer company whose own computers got penetrated, and it's sort of like a burglar alarm company getting burglarized. I mean, it's embarrassing to them, and to a certain extent they have to create a, I'm not sure if myth is the right word, but they have to really try and emphasize the evil genius aspect in order to in some way remove some of the embarrassment from their standpoint, and I think that was a factor here.
I think we have maybe a conflict of two different worlds here. We have the big business approach of lost profits, bad public image, and time and energy and CPU time and all that kind of thing. And we have that crossed with an individual person who is exploring and learning. And what's sad in this particular case is that no one is really thinking, well, what's going to happen to the individual person? The headlines talk about the profit, the profits that are at stake, but they're not talking about the fact that this man has already spent 8 months in jail at the prime of his life for something that some people would not even consider to be a crime.
Well, I have one thought about that. Now, I mean, I take sort of a middle ground. I think this is an issue of not having taught sort of a new technological morality, perhaps, to our children. I mean, I look at what Kevin did not so much as theft, but as someone who is going through a neighborhood, perhaps, and it's a very extended neighborhood. Some people call it cyberspace, but there are locked doors. I mean, he had to compromise the security of each computer he went into. I mean, it's not like the doors were locked. And so this is like somebody in a city, maybe, sort of wandering around in apartment buildings and walking in doors and looking around. And if somebody's doing that in the city, it's true, it's not a major crime, but it's not something, and people, you know, right-thinking people don't do it. I think the problem is that there hasn't been any education in the form of maybe teaching computer citizenship. We teach computer literacy. That's a big thing. But nobody really thinks very clearly about what kind of values we need to go along with the new technology.
You're listening to WBAI in New York. The program is Off the Hook, and we're talking about the Kevin Mitnick case in California, where a computer hacker has been sentenced to a year in jail and 6 months in an addiction treatment program. It's not the only case going on. There's a case in Illinois involving someone named Herbert Zinn, known as Shadowhawk. He was sentenced to a nine-month prison sentence, and he also has to pay a $10,000 fine and serve 2.5 years of federal probation. Basically, when Zinn was 16 years old, he used his home computer to break into a Bell Labs computer in Illinois and copy software. And it's mostly for the fact that he copied the software that he has been sentenced to this rather large sentence of 9 months in jail. I mean, when you're 18 years old, 9 months in jail can really be a bad trip.
I should also emphasize, if I can put in there, that 9 months or a year in federal prison now under new sentencing rules really means 9 months. There's no parole or good time or anything like that.
I also think the way we look upon this is most interesting. If you read the newspapers about the Zinn case in Illinois, you would have heard about a computer hacker that stole millions of dollars worth of software. And if you took a closer look at the case, you would have seen that this was a 16-year-old kid who copied a computer program over the phone lines, which some people might consider stealing, others might not, because the original is still right where it was left. He did not sell it. He did not damage it. He simply looked at it. And for that crime, for invading that corporation's privacy, he was sentenced to jail. And it's frightening to think of how highly we hold a corporation's privacy and how low we hold our own individual privacy. It's kind of a sobering thought. And I'd like to use that sobering thought to introduce our third guest, Richard Matthews, who is a computer hacker in Louisiana. Richard, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, you've been listening to this discussion. Any thoughts as a hacker?
Well, I think what we're dealing with here is ignorance on the part of a lot of public officials. They really are unaware of what's going on. They don't. They're not well versed in computers and computer technology, and it's a new and strange technology to them. And when they're confronted by someone who has hacked or has exhibited some computer knowledge, I think their main emotion is paranoia and a great deal of fear.
Let me just mention at this point, we are going to try to take some phone calls for anyone who wants to comment on these cases. The number is 212-279-3400. Now, Richard Matthews, you recently went through some conflict with authorities. Perhaps you could describe a little bit what took place and what some of the things you were facing were.
Well, one of the first things I noticed when I came home and found that my apartment had been searched was that apparently those doing the investigation had little or no knowledge of computers and computer technology. I noticed that the search was conducted in a manner that that allowed a lot of perhaps valuable materials to get away from them. And
could you be a little more specific on that?
Well, for instance, if I were on the other end of this and I were conducting a search, one of the first places I would look for a disk containing information would be in the disk drive, and both of my disk drives still had disks in them after the search was over, and I found that quite remarkable. And I also noticed that they took printouts and materials that had nothing to do whatsoever with the case that was being investigated. Perhaps you're familiar with a publication called 2600.
Well, in fact, I'm the editor of that publication, but go ahead.
Right. Well, I noticed one thing was that my entire collection of 2600s had been confiscated, although it had absolutely nothing to do, it had very little to do with the case they were investigating. And when I was brought in for questioning, I virtually had to give the sheriff's officers and the Secret Service agent a crash course in computers and telecommunications.
So basically they had virtually no idea what they were doing.
They had virtually no idea whatsoever.
Can you tell us in as specific or as vague a term as you desire what it was you were up to and perhaps why?
Well, a friend of mine told me that he had found an interesting number that allowed him access to a computer. So I told him to come on over to my apartment and we would take a look and see what this system looked like and what it did. So my friend came over and he logged on to the computer on the other end. He logged on and we spent a pretty good deal of time looking at the file structure of the computer on the other end and using a few of the functions to see who else was online and looking at some of the program names that were on the system. That's pretty much all we did, altering nothing, and then we left. We logged off of the system.
All right, and it was for exploratory purposes that you did this?
Right, it was almost an academic exercise. I had never before been logged on to this type of system, and I wanted to see what was there, what it looked like, just how much information could be stored, not the specific information itself. We didn't access any files that contained data. We just spent a great deal of time looking at directories and looking at file names.
Now, how easy was it for you to get into this particular computer system?
Well, I was startled at how easy it was. The computer security can best be described as non-existent. It was very, very easy to get in using just minimal knowledge of the operating system. And the password to a very high level account could have been figured out by someone with no knowledge of computers whatsoever, just brainstorming with a piece of paper and a pencil.
I see. What happened when things started going wrong for you? When was the first indication, and what was it you were facing?
Well, the first indication I had that there was trouble was when I tried to get in touch with a friend of mine who came over and logged into the system. I was told that he was in some very big trouble. that afternoon, I came home to find that my apartment had been searched. And the afternoon that my apartment was searched, I got a call from the local sheriff's office telling me to come in for questioning. And I did that. Then I was offered a reduction of sort of a reduction of charges. They would arrest me on a lesser charge if I would cooperate with them, telling them what I knew. And a lot of people give all sort of high sounding talk about how they won't break down and how they won't give in or tell what they know. But I was in effect threatened. I could either be arrested then and there on the federal charge of on the federal charge. They weren't very specific on what federal charge, or they said I could cooperate with them and I would just be arrested and charged with a state level misdemeanor. And so naturally I was figuring I should take the state misdemeanor instead and perhaps cooperate with them a bit.
There's a particular phrase that was rather intriguing. Do you recall what that was? The particular law that you were accused of breaking?
Well, when I was being photographed, when they were taking my mugshots, the officer asked me what I had done, and when I told him what I was alleged to have done, he said that he had never seen anyone before that was charged with intellectual theft of private or proprietary information. And I find that quite an interesting thing to be charged with.
Now, let me ask you one last question, and then we'll open it up for a discussion amongst the three guests and the callers. Address this to the people that might not understand what motivates a computer hacker or someone who is just very much intrigued by technology. People say it's wrong. People say that you're trespassing, you're breaking the law. Why would somebody continue to do such a thing? Is there something that motivates you?
Well, my main interest in all of this was strictly the academic pursuit of learning about computers. In general, there was no malicious intent on my part whatsoever. I strictly wanted to see how this computer was set up, how it was run, and what its storage capacities were. In effect, I wanted to see what it was. Some computer enthusiasts tend to regard computers as entities themselves, almost as individuals, because each system is indeed its own system. And I was just wanting to get to know this individual system a little better, since it was a pretty large system that I'd never seen before.
And where do you stand now as far as these legal troubles?
Well, to date, I was arrested early this year. And as of yet, I've heard absolutely nothing from the authorities concerning my case. I guess they're just going to let me sit around and wait for a while before they decide what they're going to do with me.
We're speaking with Richard Matthews, who is a computer hacker in Louisiana, as well as Alan Rubin, who is Kevin Mitnick's lawyer, Kevin Mitnick being the computer hacker who is recently sentenced to prison time and time in an addiction clinic for being addicted to computers, as well as John Markoff, reporter for the New York Times. And if anyone wants to say something now before we go to the phone calls, feel free.
Just one point. I think that the point about intellectual crimes is an interesting one. It gets right at the tension that I think has been around for a long time between the community of hackers who created the computer industry And maybe as an aside here, let me get at the differing meanings and the changing meanings of the term hacker over the last 20 years. I mean, it's the term hacker originated at MIT in the late 1950s around some engineering students who liked to play with model trains, and it then was transferred to the people who had a passion for programming and building computers at MIT somewhat later. And more recently, the media has gotten a hold of the term, and now in the public eye, it means people who like to break into computers, at least from the media point of view. So the term hackers evolved over time. But this notion of intellectual crimes, Apple Computer recently is going after a group called the New Prometheus League, who has been distributing Apple's source code, and it gets at how valuable information has become in the 1980s. Apple Computer was a company that started because a guy by the name of Steve Wozniak liked to share his new computer designs with his friends. Well, today, about the only thing that differentiates Apple Computer from its corporate competitors is its software. And the company will go to virtually any lengths to protect what differentiates it, which is just software or information, from other computer companies. So it's an interesting time.
Well, do you think we're moving into dangerous ground with such things as intellectual crimes against the state being thrown at us? I mean, what I like to say is, let's forget computers were involved here. Let's just forget there were computers. Would it be a crime if there were no computers, and would the sentence be outrageous if there were no computers involved?
Well, it's...
I think that was the point that I was trying to make earlier, is that for some reason, simply because a computer is involved, that the crime has escalated beyond belief. And I think there's also a problem going on here that clearly some corporations have an enormous amount of influence on the government and whether they will prosecute an individual. In this instance, there was, I know, substantial communications between the government and DEC. And instead of a government making an independent judgment and analysis as to whether this really is worthy of prosecution, there was a lot of pressure, if you will, I don't know, overt or subtle, that from DEC to prosecute Kevin and to really throw the book at him when, in my mind, it wasn't really justified, certainly to the extent of that he received, and certainly to the extent of the notoriety he received.
Okay, well, we're going to be giving out addresses and phone numbers later on at the end of the program. Right now, though, we'd like to take calls from the listeners. The number is 212-279-3400, and the switchboard is all tied up right now, but feel free to keep trying, and we'll try to fit you in. Good evening. You're on.
Yes, good evening. I'm very much surprised at how you can justify these particular actions under a guise of exploring. This is pure and simple theft. And if you consider that the terminology, I don't care what you call it, hackers or these innocent... look, I deal with computers too, and we're not talking about innocents here. We're talking about people behind a keyboard, people who are trying to get something that doesn't belong to them, to invade privacy, which I thought is your strong point, you people, privacy of somebody else, whether it's an individual or whether it's a business. It's still privacy, and it's still ownership by somebody else. Now, this guy, Mitnick, he is getting a course in the computer citizenship, 8 months' worth, 8 months' worth, and counting. And I really think that the more the prosecutions continue, the better off we as a society are going to be. We're not talking about individual rights here. We're talking about laws of theft and invasion of privacy.
Well, now I'm not sure if the other guests can hear you.
I'm sure they don't agree with me.
No, I'm saying that they can hear you. There's a bit of a hum on the line, but I'd just like to ask the caller a question. Obviously, you think that computer hacking is a crime, and quite a few people do, but don't you think in this particular case, the person sentenced received more of a sentence than if he had done the actual physical invasion of privacy and theft of a service.
I didn't say hacking was a crime. I said theft and invasion of privacy are both crimes. They're on the books. Okay, I'm not talking about hacking per se. And I'm not. And you're putting it under the umbrella of exploring. That's a very big and very wide circumference of an umbrella. I think what we're talking about here is not hacking or exploring. We're talking about breach of law.
Well, let me respond a little bit to that. First of all, the charge that Kevin was convicted of and pled guilty to was not theft, was not taking of anything. In fact, what he was convicted of was unauthorized access into the computer.
Is that on invasion?
Not taking anything, simply accessed the computer.
It's not just simply. Yeah, I like the way you say simply. It's not simply.
Well, I'm correcting you. He was not convicted of theft or stealing or taking anything from a legal standpoint. If you're talking about what's on the books, what he did was in the equivalent of, and what he was convicted of would be a trespass. And for example, if somebody walked into your home, onto your property, but didn't take anything, they would not be stealing or theft or burglary. They would be convicted of trespassing onto your property. And that is what the equivalent is here. He's trespassing into their computer system, and that's what he's convicted of. And the question, in my mind, and I think is pretty clear, is he walked into onto Deck's grounds, okay, or he trespassed. The sentence would have been substantially less than accessing the computer. And even without taking anything or... And as far as the matter of privacy goes, there were no private records of individuals. I think, ultimately, in each case, you have to look at what the motivation is. In any case, that's what happens in every case in a courthouse, is the motivation is looked at, what was really done was looked at in judging what an appropriate sentence is. Simply to say something's on the books, doesn't necessarily mean it should be a crime or should be treated appropriately. I mean, illegal assembly is technically a crime, but certainly when people marched against the war in Vietnam or marched for abortion rights or marched for any other reason, they may be technically committing a crime, but certainly their motivation deserves to be taken into account.
Thank you for calling, sir. We're going to take some more calls here at 279-3400. And I think another issue that we haven't really addressed as far as considering whether such actions are crimes, should it also be a crime that a corporation, an organization, an institution of some kind makes it so easy? We have a hacker on the line who says it's incredibly easy to break into these computer systems. Shouldn't those organizations bear some responsibility when people somehow manage to slide through these cracks that they've, these well-publicized cracks? I mean, 2600 Magazine prints a lot of information that, while not geared towards a specific system, can certainly show some flaws in various organizations' computers if they have not taken certain basic safeguards that a 12-year-old Apple computer owner would take to prevent people from gaining illegal access to his computer bulletin board system. And I'm sorry to say, many of those bulletin board systems are more secure than Defense Department computers. So perhaps some of the responsibility lies in these organizations. The number is 279-3400. Good evening, you're on.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes. Should I ask my question now?
Go ahead. I'm afraid you have to ask a question and then hang up because all the lines seem to have hum in them for some reason.
Okay, here goes.
Go ahead.
During the past year, people have been arrested for using modified scramblers to view satellite-delivered television programs. These include people who live in rural areas who cannot access conventional TV programs. PBS, the public broadcasting service, recently scrambled its feeds, making it a crime to view Sesame Street via satellite. Obviously, in this instance, the cable TV monopoly is behind the drive to deprive individuals of their freedom to monitor the airwaves. Do you see any parallels between this issue and the cases which you have been discussing during this program? That is, big business depriving individuals of their rights.
Okay, we're going to answer your question. Thanks for calling. Anyone want to take that one? Go ahead, John Markoff.
Well, just a comment that there has been an interesting technological war between the scramblers and the descramblers. There's a fairly lively underground, I don't know, industry or community, a little bit of both, of people who have essentially been engaged in electronic warfare with the scrambling industry. And clearly the cable industry wants people to pay for their service, and if you can just stick a dish in your backyard and receive the stuff for free, they don't make any money off of you. And so they've increasingly scrambled more and more of the stuff that is broadcast. The FBI has actually been cracking down during the last, I think, 2 years on people who have modified the systems in various ways to get around the scramblers. And it's one of those sort of technological wars where one side scrambles and the other side comes up with sort of a counter-scrambling mechanism. It's gone on for some time.
There is a parallel between the people trying to de-scramble the TV pictures and the hackers. It's kind of the same rebelliousness. I'm not involved in that particular field, but I do see it, the outrage that how dare they scramble a program and or how dare they prosecute me for just pointing my dish at the sky and receiving something. Or for de-scrambling a scrambled signal. I mean, some people would think that is illegal. Other people would say, no, there's nothing wrong with doing that. The airwaves are free. It's one of many different things going on right now in the technological revolution that are going to create some shockwaves when they're resolved. There are going to be some bad decisions made, like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986 that makes it a crime to listen to a cellular phone call. And that's it. There's no other protection required for cellular phone manufacturers. We'll make it a crime for anybody to listen to these conversations, and then nobody will intercept them. Yeah. Our number is 279-3400, and I sure hope that there's no hum on this line, but we'll see. Good evening.
Yes, good evening.
Go ahead.
Good evening to Richard and to Alan and to John. Okay. I guess I have more comments than questions, and I'd like some responses.
Okay.
Specifically directed at Richard, the fact that you were charged with intellectual theft is astonishing to me. This is a phrase that sounds like it comes immediately out of a newspaper from the Soviet Union or China. This was a standard political accusation that they would use to put someone away with. So it's just amazing to me that this is happening in the United States today. Although, what tempers that amazement, I guess, is a sense that look at the government's point of view. You are dabbling in the one thing that they have that separates them from us, which is information. The fact that you can go in and get information the way the government likes to think that it can makes them shiver in their boots, essentially. I would think that. I mean, they're looking at information as a god or an entity against which you can commit a crime.
Well, that's precisely right. They're afraid of. They seem to be afraid of anyone who has the ability or the knowledge that would allow them to access information, and in some cases, very sensitive information. But then again, a lot of citizens here would argue that Louisiana isn't truly a part of the United States.
I've heard that argument actually made, but I do a little playing with computers. I've hacked on a personal level and played locally in the metro area and looking at different people's lines and playing with passwords. And I have to vouch for the fact that you're absolutely correct that there's very little security. If you sit and play with a pad and a paper, you can break into most of the ongoing business systems locally here. People are not really setting up serious reasons that you shouldn't be able to get in there. Sort of like, well, if we put up a little bit of a wall, people will understand they're not supposed to go in, and then they won't. That's their assumption at any rate.
Yes, it's... Security on the part of the corporation is pretty lax. But one point I would like to make is that, in a sense, I stole nothing. I didn't transfer any information from the host computer onto my computer. I didn't save anything onto disk. I didn't print anything out on the printer. The only thing that I came away with when I logged off my head, and that's what got me in trouble.
was looking at information, strictly looking at it, and the only theft I committed was the theft that comes from looking.
Sir, I want to thank you for your call. We just have time for one more short call.
Thanks.
Thanks for calling in. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead. Sir, turn down your radio, or ma'am.
Okay.
Are you there? Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd just like to say that I think one of the big problems these days is a lot of younger computer hackers are like getting their hands on computers and modems, and they're not learning like actual ethics before they actually get online. And main problem with that is the fact that they're getting into basically they're getting caught, and they're setting the standard by which hackers are judged by in the eye of the public.
Yes.
And the point I want to get across is that I think that what I'm trying to say is that I think that the public is being painted like a very bad picture of hackers and freakers because of the fact of like the more destructive type hackers that are being made known to the public.
Uh-huh. Well, as we've been able to point out tonight, the most destructive hacker of them all, supposedly according to the press, Kevin Mitnick, a lot of the things that we heard about him simply aren't true, and it stems from ignorance. And I'm sorry to have to cut you off, but we are practically out of time. I want to thank our guest for tonight, Richard Matthews, a computer hacker in Louisiana. Thank you and good luck to you, and hopefully... Your individualism won't be crushed by all of this. Do you think it will?
Well, like I say, that remains to be seen. At this point, I have no idea what's going to happen to me. And under the provisions of the law, I could be sentenced to, I believe, up to a year of time in the Louisiana State Penitentiary.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen. There are enough... young people sitting in jail today already just because they played around with computers. Kevin Mitnick's lawyer, Alan Rubin, any final thought from you?
No, I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity for trying to at least set the record straight for Kevin, and I wish Richard luck.
Is there anything that that people, listeners, can do to help Kevin in any way?
Well, at this point, he's going to finish out the sentence, and if there's he would love to get into the computer industry and try and really turn his talents to productive use. So if there's someone there who wants to talk to me about it, I'd be happy to talk to them.
Okay, you can give your phone number if you want.
Okay, it would be 213-207-1114.
Okay, thank you very much for being a part of the program tonight. And John Markoff from the New York Times, thanks very much for stopping by, and I assume you're going to continue following this story and others like it in the future.
I imagine that more of these incidents will inevitably take place.
Undoubtedly. Okay, thanks again for stopping by. And for folks interested in obtaining more information, you can write to 2600 Magazine. The address is 2600 Post Office Box 752, Middle Island, New York, 11953. You can also call area code 516-751-2600. 2600 is kind of the American hacker organization. There is no real organization of hackers in this country, but 2600 is probably the closest thing to something that encompasses the hackers of this nation. Again, if you can call 516-751-2600 or write to that address. However, there is a major hacking convention in Amsterdam in a couple of days, so it's quite possible you won't get a response from us for a while, as we will be out for a while. Also, if you're interested in contacting a hacker organization in Amsterdam, it's known as HackTIC. You can call them up at, you need to call overseas though, 011-3120-600-1480. That's HackTIC. 011-3120-600-1480. Again, thanks to everybody that called in, and keep reading the newspapers and listening to what the computer hackers are up to, because it's fascinating, and the things that come out of this will wind up affecting many, many people. I'm Emmanuel Goldstein. Thanks very much for tuning in. We'll be back with Off the Hook at some point in the future. Tune in this Thursday afternoon at 1 o'clock for News of the World. We'll be hearing tapes directly from China, and I think you'll find that most interesting. Thanks again for listening. This is WBAI, New York. And coming up next on WBAI is a special presentation in the poetry of Sari. Sari, poet and cultural worker, presents her provocative poetry. Coming up next on listener-supported WBAI.
Unconsciously to her, my middle daughter would carry on the struggle. It's a process I always tried to tell her whenever she got so angry from her pain. Use your palate, darling. Yet he bludgeoned me, tried to rip apart my humanity. White Jewish girl I was. Wished I could have an Irish nose, and now I want to be black, I suppose. When will I love myself? Jewish culture. I hate the religious rabbis who laughed at girls. I smoyente ketzer. Not in my papi's eyes. It was always younger brother. I, my father, despised. Mom, Polish, Jewish, peasant girl, why didn't you help me? You degraded yourself, too. It goes...